I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 210 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. We have a really long interview this week. I think you all know the drill about staying in touch with the show. So let's just get right to the interview. Libby Emmons grew up in East Coast U.S. cities. She loved writing from an early age, but got in trouble in junior high when her parents discovered some stories that they considered obscene. She has a BA from Sarah Lawrence College and an MFA from Columbia University. Now she is an award-winning playwright living in Brooklyn, at least in her real life, not in her imaginary life. And being a playwright means that she can say the things she couldn't say in high school. She was co-founder of Blue Box Productions and was part of the Puss Collective, but she's not part of that anymore, and that's why we're going to talk. Her website has a very clever URL, liadhyinc.com, which you'll understand when you look at the letters, but I'll put it in the show notes so you don't have to write it down and get it wrong. So welcome to the show, Libby. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So would you describe yourself as a left-wing feminist?
I used to describe myself that way, and I actually downloaded a bunch of policy positions from conservative and left-leaning groups earlier this year, and it turns out that I'm kind of stuck in the middle. So I would not necessarily, I would say that I'm liberal, definitely liberal, with the idea toward individual rights and the freedoms elucidated in the Bill of Rights, those kinds of things. Definitely liberal in that sense.
I think there's a lot of people who sort of feel that way. They've always thought of themselves as progressive or liberal or left-wing or whatever, but then things happen that they're not comfortable with, and then it seems like these ideas are a package that you have to take everything. You can't pick and choose your positions.
And I think that's a new thing, this idea that if you have one position, then that is an indication that you have several other positions that people who also share your one position might have. And it's sort of this way to box all of us up and keep us from thinking for ourselves.
Yeah, maybe it's an outcome of the two-party system. I think it's been a criticism of the right for a long time, right? That you sort of see somebody with a MAGA hat and you say, okay, well, they're probably anti-abortion, they're probably pro-death penalty, they're probably anti-gay rights, and you can sort of say, okay, this is the package that you're going to get. Whereas if you have somebody who identifies as a Democrat, then it's going to be the opposite on all of those issues.
Right.
So now you've written for The Federalist, The Postmillennial, and Quillette, and many people see those as right-wing reactionary places, although I don't think everything that's written there can be classified in that way. So maybe we should start in your theater group and how you got into trouble related to transgender issues.
Sure. So the first time I wrote on transgender issues was in a play that I had written called How to Sell Your Gang Rape Baby for Parts. And in the play, myself and a good friend of mine who I used to always make shows with, we played two HR professionals in, you know, the deep, dark depths of some horrible office somewhere. And we hated our jobs and we hated everybody who we worked with. And there was an intern named Bev Ann, who we found just too horribly life-affirming and had to despise her. So when Bev Ann, and none of these characters other than myself and my friend Allie appeared on stage, so it was kind of like the audience was free to hate everybody else as well as us. So, you know, you never saw anybody get hurt or anything. Like, everything was off stage.
Right.
So Bev Ann, this life-affirming intern who also supported Trump, comes in one day, and it turns out that she had been gang-raped at a some stupid frat party, and she had ended up pregnant because of this terrible situation for this poor girl. But for us, we saw this as a great opportunity. to help her get some money and to get some money of our own. So the way that transgender played into that was that in the play, our boss, who also you never see, is transgender and at the beginning of his transition phase. And and we just, you know, horribly find that funny. All of the like little weird things, like how he always goes into the women's room and how he's like always trying to help everybody. So it was cruel, probably, but also satirical and funny. And mostly it was just for laughs. At a certain point, though, after I wrote that play, I started to hear this term cisgender. And cisgender was the opposite of transgender. And it really struck me the wrong way that one person or a group of people wanting to reclassify themselves meant that other people had to reclassify themselves as well. And I actually just had a piece come out this morning, I think a few minutes ago, in Arc Digital, talking about this feminist schism and the problem with calling people cis. So that was sort of the beginning of my delve into the rabbit hole of transgender ideology, was this idea that I had to be called cis in order for somebody else to be trans, which just made no sense to me.
Right, and humor is having a difficult time these days because humor by nature can be cruel, making fun of different people, different groups. And it's become more and more rigid, the definition of who you can, you know, safely make fun of. I mean, did you have pushback when you did this play about some of the humor or in the play and not other humor?
Yeah, the humor that there was that people found disturbing was the part where I thought it was funny to just saying this, you know, in light of how humor is these days. The part that nobody thought was funny was where we decided that the best idea was to have the Trump supporting life affirming intern bring her baby to term, at which point we would sell it on the black market for its organs.
That is pretty dark humor.
It's very dark. Now that I'm saying it out loud. Yes. It's been years since we performed it. But yeah, so people would come and they'd be like, I hate your character. And I'd be like, I know, she's awful. She's a terrible human being. But did you laugh? And they'd be like, well, yeah, I did laugh. But no one had any issue with the goofy, clownish transgender boss at the time. And in fact, I started to write a little more on that. And I first published a piece in The Federalist, I think it was in 2015, talking about how transgender ideology reinforces gender stereotypes as opposed to liberates people from them. And I co-wrote that with my husband, David Marcus, who's on staff there. Mm-hmm. And that was the first sort of opinion piece that I wrote. And he was like, you have to write this. And I was like, I can't write stuff like that. I can't do it. So we ended up writing it together. And nobody said anything. I don't think anybody noticed that I was doing this kind of work. Well, in the indie downtown art scene in New York City, no one reads The Federalist ever.
Right.
No one even noticed. I wonder if I even told anybody. I was probably just like, oh, they're going to hate me now.
One thing I observed that, you know, even a couple of years ago, there was a lot of talk about non-binary and gender fluid. And I was getting the message that some people don't think that gender stereotypes apply to them. And in reality, I think most men and most women don't feel completely comfortable with the stereotype of what being a man is, what being a woman is. But some people, you know, wanted to go even further than that. But you're right, with transgender, people are basically hopping from male to female as if there was nothing in between.
Right. And also the feminist of my mother's generation, she was in law school in the 70s, you know, and as with my father, you know, they when they got married, they hyphenated their last name, you know? So my last name is actually hyphenated, even though I never use it that way for whatever reason.
Right.
But the feminists of that era were already bucking stereotypes, and they were doing it professionally. They were doing it personally. My mother can't cook. It's almost a point of pride. You know, she would go to board meetings, you know, she was a corporate attorney, and she would go to board meetings, and she was dressed with flair because she's got an amazing sense of style, but she was wearing trousers and a blazer, you know. Sure. There was none of this like, I have to adhere to some sort of feminist appearance standard in order to, you know, be female. There was like, I'm female, I'm tough as nails, I'm going to be doing this now. So, you know, hello, you know, it's like not a thing. So then this idea, then we had like in the 80s, we had this whole Cosmo girl where you got to be sexy and powerful and corporate. And right. Then in the 90s, we had sexy, powerful, corporate, and you're this spectacular mother all of a sudden, and you can do everything, right, and right. You're this brilliant wife, and your house is beautiful and everything. So these stereotypes that that exist now that we view as, you know, female stereotypes have been building for as many decades as women have been bucking against them, certainly. I don't think it's new that we're bucking against these stereotypes. What's new is that we're being told that these stereotypes are actually the definition of what it is to be female.
I mean, it's been a long process, but women asserted, why can't we be airline pilots, you know, things that were always seen as masculine jobs. But does that mean that we have to do everything like a man? Do we have to dress like a man? Do we have to behave like a man? And exactly where does a woman's choice come in? And as you pointed out, some of the sort of society kind of went from, okay, you're going to be just like a man, wear trousers, wear a suit, or no, you're going to be ultra feminine, but still a powerful executive. And mm-hmm. I think in reality, the answer is that, you know, women should be able to have some choice, you know, within what's reasonable for the environment, right? As an airline pilot, I guess there's certain things you can't wear. You probably can't wear high heels because you can't control the airplane with high heels.
Right. Yeah, it seems like a bad move.
Yes. But I think women can still be women, but do what was previously seen as a man's job. Or, you know, when I was quite a bit older than you, you know, when I was starting to work, male secretaries were viewed with suspicion. But then I remember my mother mentioning that before World War II, secretaries were all men, and that women had to break. Right, but we quickly stereotype things. So you kind of assume, back then you assume, you know, if a guy is a secretary, he must be gay or something, right? That was kind of the way they were looked at in those days, as
the
opposed
same
to
issue, I think, with male nurses, which is absurd.
Yes, I mean, at first it was something really exotic, and there must be something strange, like, why is this man not a doctor, because men are supposed to be in charge. Why is this man in the subservient position of being a woman? But that's not a fair characterization of the job. And I think now, with so many male nurses, that people realize, well, you know, men of all sexualities and all outlooks on life can be nurses, just like mm-hmm. women can be doctors without losing sure. their womanhood.
Yeah, because womanhood isn't really something that you can lose. I mean, it's just a thing. It's just a, you know, it's just a biological reality. There's a lot of, I mean, people are always trying to dig into the differences between men and women, and there are all these conflicting brain studies, and no one can quite put their finger on exactly what the differences are mentally or what have you, and there's chemical differences, and there's all of these things. But being female isn't a choice. You know, it's not like an option. You don't get to check it off on a box. It's just a thing that you are. And you have to
yes.
walk out into the world with this body and do with it what you will. Make the choices that you
right.
wish to make.
And there are biological realities. I worked, still do in a little bit, worked with some breastfeeding advocates and over the issue of AIDS, which we don't really need to go into, but we came across some articles written by powerful women decrying breastfeeding advocates, because it seemed to me that one definition of feminism is if the men are going to be the same, is women are going to be the same as men, then breastfeeding is really awkward and we need to get rid of it. And so women who advocate breastfeeding are putting other women back into the barefoot in the kitchen.
That is a perspective, but at the same time, you could say that people who are advocating for formula are actually, you know, trying to get women to pay for something that their bodies make for free.
Right. I think it's a discussion, but I felt that some women were uncomfortable the whole thing of breastfeeding because they didn't want to admit the biological realities that men and women are biologically different. I think feminism has had a bit of a trouble getting their head around that, the reality that men and women are different, mm-hmm. and that's going to have an impact on your life if you want to have children as a woman. You can't make your husband breastfeed no matter how much you want to.
Well, there are these new things now. There's these like chest feeding kits and all kinds of crazy things that you can do. I know that breastfeeding is a very fraught thing just because it turns out that it's really not that easy. As I discovered when I had a child, I was like, oh, this is extremely difficult to make this work. But that men and women are different does not negate the fact that they are equal. I think that's a big deal. You know, equality does not mean equal in ability in all cases. It means equal under the law,
right.
Equal in the right to self-determination, yeah. You know, having agency over one's choices. That's what it means. It doesn't mean that you're the same. Equality and equity are not the same thing.
I think that's
a lot of times these days, these things are getting conflated and it's just not the same thing. You know, a homeless man on the corner with nothing is as equal as, you know, the guy driving by in his, I don't know, Prius or whatever, limousine, I don't know, whatever your moniker of wealth is these days. Those men are equal. They do not have the same thing. They do not have the same object, but they have the same rights.
Well, theoretically, if the homeless man has his, you know, small package of goods stolen, that should be taken as seriously by the police as if a rich woman has her purse stolen. But I think the reality is that that's an ideal that society doesn't quite come to terms with. And there's definitely big socioeconomic differences and is still male, female, racial, and money that makes a big difference if you're involved in a position where you're trying to earn the right.
Yeah, but I mean, just because we can't live up to our ideals doesn't mean they aren't worth having and advocating for.
Right. Well, let's talk, since we're talking about these definitional things, let's talk about the difference between sex and gender. You said, women like me aren't supposed to say that men aren't women. We're supposed to believe that some men are women. We're supposed to believe that these men who really are women really believe that they are women and that we should believe it too. Women like me are not supposed to talk about female erasure because trans erasure is more important. So do you want to delve into what you were trying to say there? And then what was the response to that?
That's basically, it was a comment on privilege theory. And what I found interesting when this is referring back to my Colette piece about the dissolution of my feminist theater company, which dissolved because I don't think men are women, oddly enough. So what was interesting to me in that moment was that the women I was working with, specifically just the director who was the most vocal at that final meeting, was not interested in discussing with me whether or not, you know, men can be women, whether or not it's reasonable for men to colonize female bodies, any of that stuff. She just wanted me to know that I was hurting people because I was speaking from a place of privilege to people who did not have that same place of privilege. So it was really just a privilege theory thing. And that's where it landed. And it's like, really, I'm not as privileged as men who can decide they're women. How is that pop? I can't decide I'm a man. I could go out there. I could do as many manly things as possible. You know, my hips aren't going anywhere.
When I first heard about bathroom bills, for example, I sort of felt we got to the conclusion without much discussion, but I didn't really.
I think you're right. I think that's exactly what happened. We did get to the conclusion without much discussion, and that's so many people are speaking out now.
Right. So as a man, I was thinking, okay, so if a man, what I would consider a man, a trans woman, dresses as a woman, lives as a woman, goes into the bathroom, what's the big deal? But now I'm beginning to realize, well, it's not affecting me. I'm not going to be in the women's washroom. So how does it affect women when biological men, many of whom are still attracted to women, are in women's only spaces, the traditionally bathrooms, change rooms, places like that?
Well, I think that prior to this whole thing, for the most part, women didn't notice when trans women were using women's facilities. I don't think women were paying a lot of attention. I mean, when you go into the washroom, you're not like checking out the other women. I'm sure that it's true in men's bathrooms as well. You kind of just avoid eye contact, you know, make room for someone to get the paper towel, and that's it. So I think before this, no one cared and no one paid any attention. I never noticed if there were any trans women changing in the gym with me, and I would have assumed that the right thing to do would be to give them as much privacy as I wanted. So bringing this to the fore and making it such a big issue, I think, has opened the door to men who would be predators, as opposed to just those people who are trans who are going where they feel the most comfortable. I don't think there was an issue with that prior to this whole dust-up.
Right. Like, I assume that a trans woman, you know, still with male genitalia, who was in a woman's change room prior to all of this discussion about bathroom bills, would be very careful to undress in private, knowing that
women saw
male genitalia. Yes.
Right. Well, yeah. And I don't think that would be an issue. And there's plenty of room for privacy. And if that's how someone is choosing to live, I have absolutely no issue with that.
Right. A lot of people are shy. A lot of people are shy about their bodies. I mean, I remember reading that there were some men who could not urinate at a urinal if there were other men there.
There's that whole episode on Seinfeld where Kramer has to get home across the park really fast to use his own bathroom.
Right.
Yeah, it's not uncommon, certainly, to want to have privacy in those moments.
Yes. And so there are men who, in a change room where all the other men are naked, will you know, carefully have a towel around them, or they'll find some way to block out because they just don't want to be seen. And so there wouldn't really be a big deal. But as you've pointed out, if a man says, I'm a trans woman, but has some kind of sexual pathology, and there have been men like this where they are very attracted to women, they might want to be naked and show off their genitalia in a women's bathroom, and that's now perfectly legal, right? In a places where
In the places where that's legal,
yes. I think another concern that you have, you've talked about things like body hacking, artificial intelligence, things like that. There's kind of been this science fiction strain, especially in technologically oriented America, where, you know, we're going to change our bodies with computers and with mechanical aids, and we're going to become superhuman. And now we have transgender people modifying their bodies, often at a really young age, in order to essentially change their sex from male to female or female to male. Mm-hmm. So what are your concerns around this trend of body modification related to transgenderism?
Well, I think those are two separate things. the idea that children should be trans, that they should be like medically transitioned prior to completing puberty seems very wrong to me for a lot of reasons. Your body's not finished growing, obviously. Your emotions are crazy at that time of your life. Mm-hmm. Being a young girl, and I'm sure it's the same for being a young man, my son is only, I guess he's almost 9 now, but he's starting to look at this kind of stuff, and I can already see like all these changes that are happening in his mind and in his body and his own confusion with it. But from my perspective as a young woman, when I was approaching the age where basically your whole body turns into something else, it was awful. It was horrifying. I didn't want any part of it. I wanted to go climb trees and run around and play in the swamp and,
right.
you know, get covered in muck and go dig up arrowheads with my cousin. You know, we had this whole fantasy. Anyway, that's what I wanted to do. And it was infuriating to me when my dad and my stepmom started saying things like, you have to wear tights with a dress. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Why am I even wearing this dress? You know, like proper shoes that you can't run in. There was stuff about hair and makeup, and I was just like, oh my God, get this all off me. It was just, I'm not really that into that stuff. Then you don't have to be. But there's this mm-hmm. idea and this expectation for young women that you turn a corner and suddenly you are pretty much the opposite of what you were 20 minutes ago. So to take that moment in a young girl's life, and for her to say, I don't want to be that, is 100% reasonable. Why would anyone want to be that? It looks horrible. You know, young girls end up with all of this extra responsibility. As soon as you start menstruating, you could have a baby if it all goes the wrong way and everything goes sideways. What a disaster. That, you know, what a difficult thing. People do it and they work through it and whatever, but that's just not the time of life to be making big decisions. It's like giving someone a bottle of whiskey and telling them to like make decisions that are going to change the rest of their life right now. It's craziness.
I mean, first of all, your body is changing. You're starting to grow breasts. You're starting to have a period. And those are changes that, you know, up till recently, you basically couldn't, as a young woman, you couldn't change that, right? You're going to have mm-hmm. your period and your breasts were going to grow how they were going to grow. And of course, some women thought they were too big.
Right.
You lost control of your body. It started to change. And I mean, to some extent, that's true of men, but, you know, in a different way. But then the second thing is societal expectations, which go along with that, right? Now you can't go out without makeup. And now if you're going somewhere fancy, you got to put on a dress. You can't wear pants. Mm-hmm. I mean, not every woman experiences the same. I mean, there's a variety of different pressures on how female the adults around them want to present, but probably a lot more than for men. You know, my son dressed in jeans and t-shirts for 95% of his teenage youth, but nobody said anything, right?
Yeah, I did too.
Yes, and I think that's more true now. A lot of people are saying, well, you know, puberty blockers or hormones, they can be stopped at any time. But there was an article in The Independent in England about a 12-year-old boy. I wasn't sure if he was 12 when he started transitioning or when he stopped. But once he stopped the hormones, he'd grow in breasts. And they were going to have to be surgically reduced, which is, wow, to me, is pretty traumatic for just taking chemicals, right? Like, this is not a reversible thing. And I
don't think
go
ahead. Sorry.
No. Just briefly to mention Jazz Jennings, which I didn't know about until I had a previous guest. But because he started to chemically change himself early and didn't go through puberty, he's not going to develop a functioning male body, which means that he cannot be fully medically transitioned to a woman because they need the male mm-hmm. parts to stimulate a clitoris.
Oh, dear God. Oh. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the other aspect of it. So it's not just the physical changes, but it is the, that's ghastly. There are the intellectual ramifications as well, because hormone development affects brain development. That's all part of it. And your brain doesn't stop growing until what, you're like 24, I think they've decided now. So I personally would not recommend that any child do anything that's going to affect their brain chemistry in a negative way or in some sort of reductive way. Because we need our brains to be functioning at the highest capacity that they're capable if we're going to approach this life, which is so traumatic and beautiful and all of the things that it is. I think that's just sort of devastating. When I was about 12 years old, something like that, I read a book about, it turned out to be this fake propaganda book called Go Ask Alice that was put out to try and get children to not do drugs. So I read this book and I was like, oh my God, I want to do drugs. Like, I want to do lots and lots of drugs. This is amazing. I won't make these same stupid mistakes that this girl made, you know, I'm not going to forget to take birth control or whatever. So I read the book. I was 12. I wanted to drop a lot of acid and I looked at it and I was like, okay, that's a super bad idea. So self, let's just wait. Just wait. You can always do that later if you want to. So when I was, you know, I went to college, I turned 18 and I was like, nice. All right, cool. I'm going to do this now. So, but there's no, I didn't miss out on anything. It's totally different. Totally different. But, you can want to do things as a child and then wait till you're a grown up to do them. We do that all the time. My brother was having a tough time when he was a kid. And I was like, listen, childhood is short. Seems like it's forever. Just figure out how you want your life to be when you're done being a child. And then when you're done being a child, you can do that. And now he does what he wants.
Right. Like rules on sex kind of in a very rough way kind of recognize this. There's a lot of 12-year-olds who are sexually, I'm not thinking of the right word, like that are sexual beings that have gone through puberty and want to have sex. But the law says, you know, if a 20-year-old has sex with you, that's a crime. And, you know, it's much better for this 12-year-old to mature mentally before they start having relationships with adults, right? That's part of our law against pedophilia. I mean, there's contradictions in this whole thing because we can't deny that some children develop sexually very, very young, but that doesn't mean that it's right for them to try to simulate an adult relationship because they're mentally not prepared for this and they're easily taken advantage of.
It's all part of a piece. Our bodies and our minds are interconnected in ways that we don't even entirely understand. And so when we attempt to rip them apart and say, you know, my mind is one thing and my body is another, we are doing ourselves a disservice as opposed to looking at ourselves as holistic beings who have, you know, agency and sensation, you know, free will and determinism. It's all... We are one creature. We can't be separated like that and still stand. Yeah, I mean, I was just like. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think this system is adding a little bit of delay, so we start talking over each other unintentionally. I was just thinking that, you know, if they take a non-sexual analogy, so a 12-year-old is, you know, talented at, you know, climbing boulders and stuff and says at 12, I want to climb Mount Everest. Now, some parents might say, okay, we're going to have, we're going to hire some Sherpas and we're going to Mount Everest, right? Most parents would probably say, look, you know, you need to develop your skills and your body strength. And when you're 18 or 20, you'll be ready. But at 12, you're not ready to do something like that. And it's not going to destroy your life if you have to do lesser things for the next 6 years.
Right. It will enhance it, probably.
I just read a paper that said that hormones increase the risk of heart disease in both men and women. And we don't really know the long-term effects of going on hormones for your entire life. I remember that women were encouraged to go on hormones, later in their life to make menopause easier. I can't remember all the different reasons. And then it turned out that that was medically a really bad idea. But it was years later, after millions of women had been encouraged to go on hormones, that it was discovered that that was actually making them get sick and die earlier.
It was a cancer risk, and they're actually reversing some of those ideas. And I think if my random read of Facebook earlier this week can be believed, which maybe it can't, I believe that the hormone replacement for women experiencing perimenopause and menopause might be coming back in different forms.
I'm always skeptical.
I'm skeptical where too.
Yes, where there's money involved. I mean, and that's something that's been very little talked about. There's a lot of money in these very expensive interventions. It's mm-hmm. a doctor who has to recommend hormones, and it's doctors that will do the body modifications. So mm-hmm. we're starting to get a financial incentive to increase the number of transgender people who are receiving chemicals or are receiving surgery. And that if you push back, you're now threatening somebody's income.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's this thing with the hormones and everything, like you mentioned, this is the creation of a lifelong medical patient who otherwise might not have been in that position. So this is decades worth of money that's going to have to be spent on this, decades worth of health insurance premium, really locks a person into a specific lifestyle, a pill taking or whatever injection lifestyle. And certainly people have that already. Diabetics have that, and people with difficult diseases have this kind of thing. But to create a person who does not have an illness and to give them a lifelong medical condition seems irresponsible. And it also seems anathema to the experience of, the idea that we should be more in touch with ourselves and be more in touch with the world around us. It's like, and those are two leftist positions in direct conflict. What about how could there be a homeopathic trans person?
Yes. It's interesting you mentioned diabetes. I remember sitting next to a diabetes researcher once on an airplane, and I was always very, I was very interested in nutrition, and I'd studied the impact of sugar when I was in university. And I said, "Is it true that many diabetics could control their diabetes through surgery, and through diet?" And you're studying drugs for these people. I mean, couldn't they do it through diet? And he said, well, yes, but nobody wants to.
Right.
So
yeah, that's an interesting thing. I read a case about a child who had these violent epileptic seizures, and they changed the parents and the doctor got together, changed his entire diet and reduced the seizures. But the way that he had to eat was, incredibly rigid, so it was difficult to follow, but it reduced the seizures. The same, I think, is true. I don't know what I'm talking about, but I had a friend who had Graves' disease, and she was supposed to have her thyroid eradicated through some chemical process, and instead she changed her entire way of eating and drinking and gave up this and replaced it with that or whatever else, and she no longer has the illness is no longer affecting her in an adverse way. That's all anecdotal, but there have to be other ways that we can do things. Not everything has to be a snip.
Right. And that's the individual taking responsibility for their body, saying, I want to be more independent of the system. The system kind of encourages dependency. And that would mean that it's in the doctor's interest to say, if a child is 12 or younger, they should be allowed to transition. I mean, there's a direct financial conflict of interest when a mm-hmm. doctor or a social worker does that, because they're going to get lifelong business from this child.
But through the whole industry. There's also the mm-hmm. the aspect too, though, where I think doctors think, and nurses who subscribe to this idea of affirming care, think that they're doing the best thing for the child. And I, especially when you start looking at all of these articles about suicide statistics for trans children who were not given affirming care, that's got to be terrifying for parents to look at that and say, okay, I could have my child do this really drastic thing to themselves, or I could not have my child at all. I don't know what's up with all of that. I don't know if all of that is, I haven't delved into those studies, but that would have to be absolutely terrifying to face that. How do you make the right decision? How do you know what the right thing is? And so that's where I think we have the real problem. It, you know, I can be not in favor of this kind of lifestyle choice for young women and for young men. What adults choose to do is obviously their own concern, and I would trust any adult to make a determination about how they wanted to live for themselves. But when we're talking about children, it's just got to be so scary, because there are not long-term studies as to what the effect of the puberty and hormone blockers are, as you mentioned, with the young person who, Jazz, who is now doesn't have enough material to create the genital structure that she wants to have. Like, that seems really difficult. Because we don't know long-term what the story is going to be with any of this. And because it's so wrapped up in a civil rights issue, and I think mistakenly wrapped up in a civil rights mm-hmm. issue, we, you know, leftists are unable to talk about it, and conservatives are just labeled, I don't know, turfy, bigot, racist, or whatever, you know, pick your negative moniker.
Right.
So, I mean, but there has to be a way to discuss these things, and silencing the debate will only damage our culture and our youth. It has to be, and there has to be a much more open way to talk about it.
There clearly is an attempt, I think, to stifle the debate. Before, I'll talk about, there's a new New York Times article maybe we can talk about briefly, but there was a panel discussion at the Heritage Foundation, a bunch of leftists talking about transgender issue, and there's so many ironies there that these people who were like Democrats, whatever, people that who saw themselves on the left had encountered an issue, say, with a child, and saying that they couldn't get any support or any intelligent discussion except from people on the right. One woman said during this discussion, which is on YouTube, without my knowledge, pediatric endocrinologists taught my daughter, a minor, to inject herself with testosterone. She then ran away to Oregon, where state law at the age of 17 allowed her to undergo a double mastectomy and radical hysterectomy. I mean, that must be terrifying, because the woman is the mother is probably thinking, you know, if my daughter changes her mind when she's 25, she has lost the potential of being a woman, whether that's a heterosexual woman or a lesbian. In either case, she would have a body that could bear a child and that could be a woman's body. But now she has neither, because she's this idea that she's going to get a man's body is really a delusion.
It is a delusion. Yeah, it is a delusion. I mean, unless we're going to get to the point where we were talking, you know, you mentioned AI and body hacking earlier, unless we get to the point where we can create new silicon style, you know, bodies that we can then inhabit, in which case you're still not a man, but you are something more resembling a man than a woman who has transitioned to be male. And then you have to trust your, I mean, what would be these new sensory inputs that you are getting? What would those be like? What is that? Your interface with reality would be drastically different. But yeah, I don't think that a woman can make that. I don't think you could make that work. Maybe we'll get to the point where it's much better than the technology is right now, the flesh technology, as it were.
Yes.
You know, but even so, these should be adult decisions. These should not be decisions for children to make.
Yes, I agree, because as I guess you haven't had a teenager yet, but they are...
I'm looking forward to it.
Well, you know, there's times where the slightest thing is a major crisis. And as an adult, you can see, you know, this is not really a big deal. But to that child that day, you know, not getting invited to a friend's birthday party, or not having anything to wear, or you know, not having big enough breasts, these are like crises that are going to destroy my life, right? Whereas, you know, you're going to look back 10 years and probably laugh at those things. And, you know, teenagers drive parents crazy. I can remember when my two daughters started to dress in extremely revealing clothing when they were like 15 or 16. And I was uncomfortable with it, but I just hoped that, you know, nothing bad was going to come of it. I didn't think they were really old enough for that, but, you know, they were bound and determined that they were going to do that. And I was just sitting at home hoping that everything was going to work out okay.
Work out. Yeah, my mom in always let me change my clothes if I dressed like that. She's never let me out of the house.
Well, as a man, I didn't think I could control my daughter's clothing, but it didn't mean that I wasn't, you know, concerned that they were going to get some untoward attention, which is not to blame the woman, but you know, I didn't want my daughters, you know, I wanted everything to be perfect for them. They were my daughters, of course.
Right.
Of course. So in the New York Times article, I think it's clearly a complete mischaracterization of an event that happened where there was a meeting involving a woman called Ms. McBride, a trans woman, and two feminists from England, I think, came in and started to talk to her. Ms. McBride wouldn't look at them and wouldn't say anything. Now, it says there's a few things in the article that I looked at the video that are clearly wrong. It says they barged in. Well, they walked in, uninvited, but they walked in. Heckling, maybe that's true. They were talking in a fairly soft tones to Ms. McBride, trying to get her to respond, and she wouldn't respond. They used words like stormed onto Capitol Hill for the purpose of ambushing Sarah McBride, when in actual fact, they were on Capitol Hill for something else, and I don't think you can characterize the video as storming. But the article, it's only an op-ed, so I guess it's an opinion.
Yeah.
But it's reflecting it's reflecting the idea that feminists who are opposing transgender rights are hate-filled people.
Right. Sort of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, did you read this article? Do you have any comments on what you saw in it and maybe the video?
I didn't get a chance to look at the video. But I do find it kind of interesting that there are now these two sides of the feminist argument, and that they're both calling the other kind of hateful. So, you know, you have this idea of the TERF, right, the trans exclusionary radical feminist, and then you have the idea of the ultra woke leftist woman who accepts anybody to the gender party. And neither of them, I think, I was not aware where I was going with that, but I don't think anyone is particularly hateful at all. The women who are opposed to transgender ideology have very clear and salient points about it, which I could go into. But the ideologues, the other side, are mostly coming at it from an emotional perspective. It's I feel that I am a woman, so therefore I am, and who are you to deny my feelings? And the women on the other side are saying, like, you know, female isn't a feeling, it's just a reality. It's just, it's a fact of life.
Well, watching the video, I saw them make 2 points. One of them was they were opposed to body modification, to mm-hmm. radical mastectomies, hysterectomies in children. And mm-hmm. they also mentioned cases where a man had declared themselves to be a woman, and in one case in the United Kingdom had been housed in a woman's jail and had then sexually mm-hmm. assaulted several women in the jail. And that's not to say that every transgender woman is a violent rapist, but it's certainly an issue, right? If somebody can declare themselves a woman and then invade women's spaces, but they're actually doing that in order to gain access to women's bodies, that is a big problem in those individual cases. It needs to be talked about.
Yeah, I think what that has to do with is standards. And I think too much in Western culture these days, we are conflating standards and giving equal value to every perspective, every emotional perspective. And we've lost touch with the idea of rationalism and reason, in part because we have the left telling us that rationalism and reason are remnants of colonialism, which is absolutely absurd. So if what we have is a situation, let's take this example of the prison or the woman in the woman in a Toronto women's refuge who ended up having to share a room with a trans woman, and it was like right. super traumatizing for her or something. So, which I could see. I mean, if I'm like getting beat up by my husband, I land in a women's refuge. I don't want to share a room with a man. So,
right.
But these are emotional realities, right? There's every possibility that the trans woman is rational, reasonable, and isn't going to do that. And there's every reason that the abused woman is as well, right? But there's also, as we've seen, the possibility that instead the emotional realities are going to take charge. And then what we have are two emotional realities vying for dominance, and we have to apply some set of standards to determine which emotional reality is going to be the one that wins the day. This is an absurd way to behave. This is just absurd because emotional realities are constantly shifting. You feel something today, you don't feel that way tomorrow. You know, emotions are not something that we can base any kind of meaningful policy decision on, or even any kind of, you know, basic civil social program or way that we interact. We have to look at things from a reasonable and logical perspective, or else we have absolutely nothing. We have absolutely nothing except who can scream the loudest. You know, it's like everybody's the soccer player throwing themselves on the ground trying to get somebody else a red card.
I think there's been a decision made that one side's right, one side's wrong. We have to pick a side, as opposed to, you know, let's have a discussion and what's reasonable. If mm-hmm. if a man has a history of sexual abuse of women and transitions to a woman, you know, is it going to become a crime to use their male name when in actual fact it's necessary to do that to ensure the safety of women? Mm-hmm. You know, it that doesn't necessarily
negate.
Just
to have accurate record keeping, you know, even mm-hmm. just to have accurate record keeping, it's good to, you can't be like, who gets to do that? Who gets to like step up to the plate at 35 and be like, everything I've done to this point, that is, no, I am now XYZ and only what I do from here on out matters. Ask the governor of Virginia, if that's how life works. No one gets to do that. You know, we carry with us a trail of our experiences and behaviors. We can't just, regardless of forgiveness, we can't just negate them. I mean, avoid them.
I agree. We could talk about that. I mean, I think there's a place for forgiveness, but not erasure, right? Like, we shouldn't be erasing the fact that governor came from a racist environment and that his mm-hmm. yearbook was racist. The question of whether 35 years later he can be forgiven and he is a different person, that's a separate question. I think those two questions have become conflated. You know, now if you do something stupid when you're a teenager, that could destroy your career 30, 40 years later. I think it depends on the circumstances.
Yeah, it makes it pretty nice to have grown up in the 90s before everyone had cameras on their hands.
Yes. Yeah, I hate to think some of the discussions I was involved with as a kid, because racism was just in the air. You know, I didn't even, it took until I matured, I didn't even realize that, you know, I was listening to racist jokes all the time. You know, they were derogatory terms in jokes when I was a child. You know, WAP for Italians, Polacks for Polish, the N-word, Pakis for Pakistanis. Like that was just, yes, that was just normal until I realized, you know, gee, I got a friend who's Pakistani. Should I be, you know, using that slur, right? Like you have to grow up. But what if there was video of me repeating a joke because I was immature?
Maybe you'd lose your whole life. Maybe you'd lose your livelihood and everything.
Yes. Anyway, that's a whole different issue. But we're kind of running out of time. But you know, do you want to close us off? Where are you going to go from now? I presume that you still have a career as a playwright, as a writer. Things have changed for you.
Let's see, what am I doing these days? I'm doing a lot of this sort of cultural critique kind of writing. I'm very interested in tech, feminism, and art. So that's mostly what I research and what I write about and what I do. I'm working on a play called Sanctuary at the Oak Grove that was a commission from a company called SF Olympian a little more than a year ago. So I finished a draft of that. It's about the cult of Diana at Lake Nemi in Rome, or near Rome, back when there was a cult of Diana. Yeah, so that's really a lot of fun. And it actually touches on a lot of this stuff. It's a play about feminism and art and all kinds of things. And that's really a lot of fun. I'm working on that with a group here in the city. So we'll see if that goes anywhere. Could be exciting.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I'm doing.
I'll be interested to hear that how that works out.
Me too. So.
Yes. Well, I'd like to thank you very much for sharing your perspective on this. There are multiple perspectives, and I appreciate yours and for you being brave enough to come forwards and talk about this.
Oh well, thanks. I don't know how much bravery it is, as I can't keep my mouth shut, but either way, you know.
Yes. I guess the same that way. But thank you very much for joining me today.
Great. Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to episode 210 of the Infectious Network.